Mr. Axel, before you begin, I understand we have some guests here from Argentina. So, muy buenos dias y bienvenidos.
Go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. Tony Axum representing the appellant Thomas Fields. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Appellant Thomas Fields seeks remand for resentencing because his sentence was substantively unreasonable. The district court imposed a sentence that it had already said was greater than necessary to accomplish the statutory goals of sentence. As a matter of policy, at the outset of sentencing, the district court disagreed with the harsh crack guidelines and was not going to calculate the defendant's sentence under the guidelines using the guidelines at that time, but was going to use a one-to-one ratio. The court referred the parties to its own decision in United States v. Lewis, where it outlined the reasons for that policy approach. That the guidelines didn't exemplify the commission's institutional role. They weren't empirically based. Secondly, that the assumptions about crack and the harm from crack versus powder cocaine had not been borne out. Third, the disparity punishes low-level offenders and does not punish high-level offenders to the same degree because those offenders usually deal in cocaine and powder.
I'm confused about your argument. The district court came up with a below-guidelines range, right? And that got trumped by the mandatory minimum.
That is correct.
So your objection is to the additional 2 years for perjury, right?
It is to the additional 2 years perjury because the district court didn't have discretion to go below the mandatory minimum. If the district court had had discretion to go below the mandatory minimum, obviously we would be.
Well, but he explained that because of the mandatory minimum, there was no additional punishment for perjury. And that's why he added the 2 years. That's the issue, correct?
That is the issue.
So,
I don't think it's accurate to say that there was no additional punishment for perjury. The district court itself set out a procedure that it would follow.
But the court said that. That was the court's reason for imposing the additional 2 years, wasn't it? That with the mandatory minimum, there was no additional punishment for perjury. That's why
that is what the court said. But
yeah,
the mandatory minimum actually removed all discretion from the court and wasn't
discretion to go below.
Below it, not above it.
Yes,
right.
Yes, to go below.
Correct.
Definitely. But the mandatory minimum one was based on the very crack guidelines or the very crack rationale that the district court began the sentencing rejecting.
He had no choice. You agree he had no choice. He was bound by the mandatory minimum, right?
He was bound by the mandatory minimum.
So he couldn't go below it.
He could not go below
it. And so his reasoning was because of that, and because of the need to provide additional punishment for perjury, I need to add 2 years. And so explain why that's the issue, isn't it?
Because, yes, but it's the statutory mandatory minimum that
Your point is, let me see, your point is, look, if he didn't have the mandatory minimum, right, there would have been a much shorter sentence because he would have added the 2 years how many months, what did he say he would do at one-to-one, how many months?
At one-to-one, the guideline range that he calculated was 51 to 60.
51, so he would have added the 2 years to that.
Actually, he would not have added the 2 years to that because within the 51 to 63 months, he had already added 2 points under the guideline guidelines provision.
So he added, in other words, he added the 2 years to that sentence, correct?
He added 2 years,
Yes. Okay, and what he said was, now that I'm trumped by the mandatory minimum, I've got to add the 2 years to that. Well, and your point is that if less than the mandatory minimum would have been enough to punish him, why couldn't the mandatory minimum do that, correct?
That is correct.
And that's your argument.
I believe I misspoke when I said he added 2 years to the original to the one-to-one guideline base offense level. He added 2 points to the one-to-one guideline base offense level, and those 2 points were for the obstruction of justice, which was the perjury. The guidelines themselves provide for a mechanism for courts to punish.
But once the mandatory minimum trumped everything, I don't see why there is an obligation for the district court to have assumed that the mandatory minimum provided sufficient punishment. Maybe, I mean, he could have, right? But he decided it didn't.
The district court essentially decided that there were 2 sentences that were sufficient but not greater than necessary to accomplish the statutory goals of sentencing. In one scenario where he used the one-to-one and applied the obstruction enhancement as well as the gun enhancement, he decided after calculating that scenario that that was sufficient but not greater than necessary to accomplish the goals of sentencing. The statutory mandatory minimum comes along, and without regard to the 3553A factors, requires the court to impose a higher sentence. Rather than add, for example, the 12 months that were added to the base of, to the original base offense level, the district court calculated the perjury guidelines, which the guidelines themselves don't even provide for separately calculating the perjury guidelines. They provide a 2-point enhancement. So,
but he was quite clear that with respect to the additional 2 years that he added to the mandatory minimum, he was not purporting to apply the guidelines directly to the matter. He was using them, but certainly not purporting to apply them. In other words, it was not a guidelines bump for obstruction.
It was not a guidelines bump in the strictest sense.
And he thought that in the situation that the mandatory minimum had put him in involuntarily, the full 2-year additional was the best way of addressing the various purposes of the guidelines.
But it was the mandatory minimum that put him in that position, and the mandatory minimum
It put him in that position, right? And that's the raw fact that he had to face and we have to face.
That is correct, but it was not as a result of the actual perjury or actions by Mr. Fields' background and history or the nature and circumstances of Mr. Fields' offense. It was
the application of the whole set of relevant principles and law to the situation. And the two big things in that were the guidelines themselves and the mandatory minimum. And once the mandatory minimum kicked in, the judge understandably wanted to examine the question of adequate disincentives to perjury, and noting the guidelines but not purporting to follow them, he accordingly added time for that. The time being still leaving a sentence way, way, way below the guideline sentence, let's say the pure guideline sentence.
That is correct. However, the problem for the district court is the district court's mandate at sentencing is to impose a sentence sufficient but not greater than necessary. And the district court, even after it articulated that it was going to add the 24 months and to the mandatory minimum, said, if it were not for the mandatory minimum, I would apply the base offense level for the crack, the 2 points for the obstruction, and the 2 points for the gun, and I would apply a sentence of 63 months, the high end of the guidelines.
Correct.
So the district court is saying 2 different things at once. It's saying this lower sentence is sufficient, but greater than
one's dealing with a hypothetical contrary to fact, right, and the other is dealing with the situation he confronted. So of course he said two things.
Right, and with the mandatory minimum in place, he believed that the sentence was not sufficient because there was no additional time for perjury, and he explained that.
I won't belabor that point.
Okay. Anyway, that we understand your argument, right?
Yes.
Okay.
With regard to the second argument, as with regard to whether the Fair Sentencing Act applies to Mr. Fields' case, we recognize that Bigsby was a defendant in the same situation, and this court has ruled that defendants pending appeal are not eligible for a sentence reduction pursuant to the FSA. I would note, however, that Bigsby does not recognize Dorsey, which was decided actually the day before Bigsby, but and Bigsby does not recognize on any level that the Fair Sentencing Act has retroactive applicability, which Dorsey obviously did and does.
But not a retroactivity that would affect this defendant, correct?
I don't think that Dorsey forecloses the argument that retroactivity could affect someone who is pending appeal. But however, I recognize that Bigsby does.
Okay, fine.
Bigsby is dealing with a different set of defendants pending appeal. Dorsey is dealing with defendants who committed their crimes prior to enactment of the Fair Sentencing Act, but were sentenced after August 3rd, 2010, when it was actually enacted.
Okay, so do you have is there any remaining argument on this issue, or are we bound? Is this issue over now for purposes of this case? Or are you making another argument, notwithstanding Bigsby?
Unfortunately, I'd have to concede that Bigsby
okay.
bounds this court.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you. Mr. Hill?
May it please the court, John Hill for the United States. The trial court in this case did not abuse its discretion when, after correctly calculating the applicable guidelines range, it sentenced appellant to a term 91 months below the bottom end of that presumptively reasonable range. Indeed, not only was the sentence, which, as the court has noted, accounted for appellant's in-trial perjury below the pre-Fair Sentencing Act guidelines range, were we to calculate the current guidelines range after the post-Fair Sentencing Act, appellant's sentence would still be 7 to 44 months below what that presumptively reasonable range would be. So whatever metric we use, this is a reasonable sentence. As to the issue of the mandatory minimum, all sides agree that the starting point is not the district court's one-to-one variant guidelines, which were less than half of what the mandatory minimum required, but rather the starting point is the mandatory minimum. And the only question that remains for the court is whether or not adding the two-year term for perjury based on what a similarly situated person convicted of perjury would be facing was in fact a reasonable decision. And in this case, for all the reasons that the district court explained, that would be reasonable both as a method of calculation and also in terms of what the resultant total sentence would be, both under the pre-FSA guidelines and post-FSA guidelines. As to the two remaining issues, appellant has conceded both of those, both that Bigsby forecloses his retroactivity argument and that on the motion to continue point that this court's decision in Lawrence forecloses his argument there. So unless there are any further questions.
What about, I'm sorry, Karen. I just wanted to ask you about the additional 24 months for perjury. You cite U.S. v. Donegan for the proposition that adding time for perjury is okay, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But isn't Donegan a little different from this case? In Donegan, the court justified that. It says it furthers the legitimate sentencing goals relating to the principal crime, including the goals of retribution and incapacitation. And here the district court, that's not why he added the 24 months. He specifically said that he isn't saying that this particular defendant thought about the possibility of being able to lie on the stand. He's talking about the hypothetical defendant.
He did not make a specific finding on that point one way or the other. But what I think he recognized, and he recognized it consistent with the 3553 factors that he has to consider, are things such as deterrence. What's the message that we're sending? If two people who both are facing a mandatory minimum come before the court, if there is no penalty for perjury, whatever the motivation for that perjury, and the motivation would be clear, it is to try to get off the charge. So it is going to be tied to the crime. Can't imagine a motivation other than that. But it sends a message that you can get away with perjury for free.
But it's a generic message. He's talking about the future defendants.
It's
and they can always be prosecuted for perjury.
Well, but I think that's Dunnigan's point, is that...
Well, but Dunnigan's talking about punishing the defendant before them.
I think that's right.
He says, the district court said, I'm not saying that this was Fields' thought process, but a hypothetical defendant in his situation would think. You don't think that's a difference from Dunnigan?
I don't think so, uh-huh. And Your Honor, I don't think the court had to make a specific finding uh-huh. as to what the intention of the defendant was here. I think that there's only one reasonable intention for perjury. I mean, perjury is finding that someone intentionally provided false testimony as to a material fact. He's doing it on a trial in which he is the defendant. The only reason you do that is you were trying to effectively evade the charges against you. And so your only motivation could be that, the same as that motivated the defendant in Dunnigan, the same that would motivate any defendant in a perjury or in a criminal trial to commit perjury, which is to avoid the criminal charge. So I don't think this is a different situation than what the court faced in Dunnigan. And I think that the reasons that the court articulated, reasons which are consistent with the 3553A factors, such as respect for the law and deterrence, that a court has to consider, all support the court's decision to add an additional term for perjury so that this defendant would not be receiving the same sentence that a defendant who did not perjure himself would have received.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
The government respectfully asks that the court affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you. Does Mr. Axon have any time? All right, did you want to take a minute, Mr. Axon?
Thank you. I would just like to clarify that although we recognize that Bigsby binds this court, we do not agree with the reasoning of Bigsby in light of Dorsey, because Dorsey clearly carves out an exception or clearly indicates that the Savings Clause does not prohibit retroactivity of certain parts of the Fair Sentencing Act.
All right. Thank you.